Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. This is a recording from the monthly Oldie Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club. To book a ticket, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk/lunches. Our last speaker, Merlin Holland, is Oscar Wilde's only grandson, the son of Vivian Holland, the younger son of the great master. Much more important than that, he was the wine critic of the Oldie. Yeah. But he is a great writer and a great scholar. He's the co-editor of the Complete Letters of Oscar Wilde and the editor of the Irish Peacock and Scarlet Marquis, the first uncensored version of his grandfather's civil trial in 1895. And he's written an absolutely terrific, very moving book called After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal. Ladies and gentlemen, Merlin Holland.
Thank you very much, Harry. Does this bend a little? No.
It does bend, yeah.
Oh, well, I'll have to cope with it.
Keep close to the microphone.
Yeah. Okay. One of the troubles with being the last on the list is that one sometimes enjoys one's lunch too much, and if the speaker enjoys his lunch too much, then the diners don't enjoy the speaker. But I will try and condense this monster of a book, which, as I've said to somebody, took me 15.6 times the gestation period of an African elephant, is difficult in 10 minutes, but I shall do my best to do it and not overrun. I was never going to write this book. It was not something which I felt viscerally obliged to do for my family. It came about more or less by accident. As a child, I was always discouraged from taking an interest in Oscar Wilde. It was the 1950s and the 1960s, a period of really quite disgusting homophobia in British history. Let alone admitting that I was in any way related to him. I was coached by my parents to say, if anybody asked, was I related to Oscar Wilde, to say, yes, but he died a very long time ago and I never knew him, and changed the subject. So during the 1950s, when my father went bankrupt because of Stafford Cripps, known in the family as Stifford Craps, imposed as Chancellor of the Exchequer the one-off special levy, which was basically a tax on unearned income, my father, like most self-employed people, was paying his tax next year with the income of the year after. And so by 1950, they made him bankrupt. My mother offered to pay it off, and they would have been well advised to accept her offer, except that I have always assumed, perhaps wrongly but not unreasonably, that the British establishment, having stuck Oscar Wilde into prison in 1895, was going to get an extra pound of flesh out of my father. He appeared with my mother on the front page of the Daily Mail, dressed in evening dress, with my mother with a fur stole. Front page of the Daily Mail, photograph, Oscar Wilde's son faces Carey Street. And they even managed to bring in my mother's association with Buckingham Palace as the Queen's beauty advisor. So, understandably, I was protected, I think, by my mother, is the best way of putting it, against the incursions of the press into our lives. I think somebody disapproves of what I've been saying. It's happened several times. At one point, I wish I could tell you some of the stories, but the time is far too short to do so. Anyway, when my father died and I came down from Oxford, I went to live abroad in Beirut for 4 years, and I came back to find my mother in a state of panic about what she referred to as all these funny academics, because in 1962 Oscar's letters had been published, and they turned him from this two-dimensional cardboard cutout funny man who was struggling to rise above the first division of serious English literature, into an author whose works were worthy of study by the academic world. And so people would come to my mother and ask her permission to quote from his letters, and she would pass the letter on to a solicitor who charged her £15 for the privilege and charged the academic £5 for doing it. It was obviously a very uncommercial proposition. So I took over, and we had terrible arguments about Oscar Wilde. My mother wielded her whitewash brush over bits of Oscar's life which she felt didn't do the family reputation any good. And when Richard Ellman's book was about to come out, and I heard that he was going to make idea that the rumour that Oscar had contracted syphilis at Oxford and finally died of it in 1900, one of the major themes in the book. And it was one of the only occasions I took my mother's side. And I did a lot of research into contemporary accounts and correspondence and so on. And what it taught me, and the reason I'm telling you this, is that it taught me that everything to do with posthumous Oscar Wilde was sown with imaginative and completely exaggerated accounts of what had happened in his life, what had happened after his death. And I felt that it was time that history should be put right. And it was from that moment onwards that I felt that a book on the subject, this was way back in 1997, was due. It took time. It took time because I had criticised for years the sloppy research and even what I referred to as the follow-my-leader biographers who would pick up on something in another biographer's book and without even verifying the sources would simply repeat it. And with repeated publication, such gossip eventually became enshrined in fact. So having been critical of others, I felt that I had to play by my own rules. And that meant doing an enormous amount of research, which is why it's taken so long. There was a joke which I used to repeat about the two Irishmen who meet in the pub. And one says to the other, "What are you doing these days?" And the second one says to him, "Writing a book." And the first one says, "Neither am I." And that rather typified, I think, amongst my friends, the lack of appearance of this book, which I've been talking so often about. Anyway, I was asked recently whether I thought that bits of it might upset people, to which I replied, "Well, I certainly hope so." There are parts of this book, parts which I have discovered, which will not do the descendants of the people I've written about any favours. If it brings a blush to their cheek, then I'm happy with that. I don't know whether there's anything in the idea that there is a certain amount of hard wiring in genetics from one generation to another, but if there's anything, any tiny piece that I may have inherited from my esteemed grandpa, it's the delight in being able to poke fun at the establishment and calling into question the behaviour of people who have, one can only say, been hypocritical about him. People who, for example, have polished their own reputations in the 1920s by saying they stood by him financially and morally in his downfall, when it's perfectly provable, and I say proving the negative, of course, is a very difficult philosophical proposition, but I can prove that this is absolutely not the case, and these examples have been put into my book. I just quote a couple of them to you. One is the I hope that there is nobody here today from the council or whatever they call it, the Royal Society of Literature, but in the 1920s, André Gide was granted an honorary foreign fellowship at the Royal Society of Literature. And in 1933, it was taken away from him. And the reason it's, for most biographers, that it was taken away is because of André Gide's closeness to the communist regime of Russia at the time and Stalin. And in fact, it turns out that it was Robert Sherard, one of Oscar's very heterosexual friends and a sort of devoted spaniel to his memory after his death, who had written to the Royal Society of Literature and said, "How on earth can you give an honorary fellowship to this man who is a homosexual and a pervert?" And they appointed a subcommittee, and within a month they had written to him saying, "I'm terribly sorry, but we have rescinded the fellowship." I hope that the Royal Society of Literature, I know that the Royal Society of Literature today, of course, is much more tolerant and much more understanding of such things, but it's interesting to think that in the 1930s this happened. There was one other thing, that in the 1950s, around the time that the Wolfenden Report had been commissioned, I don't think it had been published by that stage, one of the noble lords in the upper chamber, in debate on the reform of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, which put my grandpa behind bars, was said by Hansard to have described it as filthy and disgusting and unnatural vice. When I was at Oxford, 10 years after the 1890s, when such things were rife, it had all been eradicated. The fact that Oscar Wilde had been sent to prison was obviously the reason for it. Finding out these things was a little more disturbing when it came to my own father, and correcting his mistakes, exaggerations, I would certainly wouldn't call them lies, but perhaps faulty memory, the tying up of loose ends conveniently with a story which might have been true but might not have been, simply to make things more easily comprehensible to his readers. And I've had to do this, and I felt a pang of disloyalty in doing it. But at the same time, for example, the eminently repeatable story of him, my father Vivian, Cyril, and my grandmother Constance being thrown out of a hotel in Switzerland because of who they were. The hotel keeper knowing that they were related to Oscar Wilde and believing it would possibly be bad for business if they stayed. And this I repeated for years and years until I discovered that in fact they were simply moved into the annex. And revealing this gave me a pang of conscience, I have to say. But I realised that in fact what it was my father, who wasn't, it was neither exaggerating nor lying, but in 1954, 59 years after the event, he still felt that sense of shame, of rejection, of something being wrong in the family, and that's what he recorded in his first volume of autobiography. So that feeling had lived on for nearly 60 years, and that to me was much more important than the fact that he might have exaggerated slightly about being thrown out of the hotel. And that has been made the major theme of my book, to find the reasons for people not quite telling the truth, and in many cases the reasons behind the fact that they didn't tell the truth, whether it's for massaging their own reputation for posterity, whether it was for tying up the loose ends, whether it was for putting bums on seats in the cinema, or simply selling more books. The reasons behind the exaggerations and the lies and the untruths, which I have discovered over these years, are frequently more poignant and more telling, and in some cases very significant in the whole history of homophobia in Britain over the, I would say, the first three quarters of a century of the 20th century. The book, the last thing I'd like to say to you is, those of you who have bought the book, please, before long, open it, not just to read it, but open it and see how beautifully it opens, and that you don't have to break the bloody back of the book in order to get into the gutter. I insisted that the publishers, they didn't take a lot of persuading, and I insisted that the publishers stitched it in signatures, so that when this book, if it does finish up on library shelves, alongside those complacent books about the myths that I have been trying to bust, when a library buys a so-called perfect bound book, the spine chopped off and glued and the pages fly out after 10 or 15 years, they don't rebind it, it's not worthwhile, they throw it away, and so the myths will survive. So having persuaded the publisher to produce a properly bound, stitched book, I hope that my busting of the myths will sit on the library shelves and counteract what I have been trying to fight for the last 15.6 times, the gestation of an African elephant. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.